My name is Kendra Pierre-Lewis, and I want to thank everyone for coming to this session on Beyond the Bubble, how to communicate environmental issues outside the echo chamber, a topic I think that's near and dear to our hearts. Before we get started, a couple of ground rules. We will take questions sort of throughout. People with blue badges get priority when you, because it, like working reporters, basically, sort of standard rules, everything is on the record. And when you ask a question, please have it be a question and not a speech, unless it's a really good speech. And if you would like to tweet it throughout, that would be awesome. We really welcome tweeting. And I think that's it. So without too much ado, I will introduce our panel of speakers. So first up, I have Jamin Bogie, I was right the first time, and who is a policy and outreach coordinator with the Group Against Smog and Pollution. We have Shanti Gamper Rabindranara, who is an associate professor at University of Pittsburgh. And then we have, not Todd, we have Mary Hoff, from who is with NCIA. And I will let them each introduce themselves a little bit. And then also sort of like an opening question is sort of, what do you think journalism is getting right about communicating environmental issues broadly? Or what do you think journalism is getting wrong? So,
hey, thanks, everyone, for coming out to this. Like she said, my name is Jamin Bogie, Group Against Smog and Pollution, also known around here as GASP. We are an environmental nonprofit. We are older than the Clean Air Act. We will be coming on 49, 50 years soon. The caveat is that I work for them, and my job is to put out an environmental message. And sometimes that's talking to the media, and sometimes that's talking to the community. And your job is to listen to what I say and decide if I'm telling the truth or not. So take that as a caveat, and maybe you'll learn about things from the other side. I'm totally biased, but I also happen to believe in everything I say, so I have that luxury. I don't envy all of you. I had a lot to say about right and wrong. I'll just give one idea. I think sometimes good information gets hurt by the he said, she said aspect of a story, where to get multiple sides, talk to multiple people, at least from my perspective, the reader ends up thinking, well, this person is way over here, this person's way over there. They yelled at each other, and now the article's over. I guess they're all crazy. And I would love to see, instead of just getting the two or three sources you need, following the thing, I would like to see, I believe the truth would be better served by pursuing it another few levels. So I had a lot more to say about that, but this was supposed to be a few minutes, so I'll pass.
My name is Shanti, and I teach at University of Pittsburgh. So welcome to Pittsburgh. Excited to have you all here. So I work on energy, environment, health, and development. And I just wrote a book on the shale dilemma, a global perspective on fracking and shale development. So I'm using this as free PR. So there's some yellow sheets out there, if you could take a look. I actually am very excited about the work that journalists have done. You've done an excellent job, at least for the shale industry that I've studied. You guys have done an excellent job. And I can enumerate how you guys have done such a great job. Environmental issues are public health issues, core public health issues. It affects the air we breathe and the water we drink. So among people who have done coverage in this, Lisa Song, she covered air pollution in the Eagle Ford area. Abraham Lustgarten, he covered how by mistake oil and gas wastewater was injected into non-exempt aquifers. This is incredible. Like, the rest of the public did not know this until the information came from these journalists who really did a lot of digging. And I find that journalists have expounded the difficult and fraught trade-offs among energy and economic development and public health issues. So Jason Howard did this article on mountaintop mining. And how, you know, there is a really fraught relationship between those relying on these industry jobs who at the same time wish that they had options that did not impair their health. So I thought that the coverage was very, very well balanced in trying to get this idea that, you know, it is a difficult trade-off. On the one hand, you want bread and butter, but on the other hand, you also want your public health. The other area that our journalists have done excellent work on is in filing Freedom of Information Act. This is like really tough to do because you need the resources, and if you need to go to court, you need the resources to do so. And for the shale, the whole shale thing, Laura Legere at Scranton News did excellent work on this. She actually, as a result of her work, people in Pennsylvania learned about this public positive determination letters, basically that the DEP puts out whenever there's evidence linking oil and gas operations to water contamination. We couldn't get that information until Laura filed the FOIA, and she actually, I think, went to her newspaper went to court for that. And then the last point that you guys have made such a great, so much good work in is on governance and public integrity. So there was a bunch of art series looking at revolving doors between regulators and companies. Again, excellent work. Another final piece that I thought I should really raise is there was a coverage by Mother Jones on shale in China. It was very, it's impossible to get this kind of information, and they were on the ground getting information. So I think journalists are doing excellent work, and it's great that you guys are part of the pillar of democracy. Okay.
Great. Thank you, Shanti. And thank you, Kendra, for inviting me to be on this panel. My name is Mary Hoff. I am editor-in-chief of... I'm about to pour an entire pitcher of water on the floor. I am editor-in-chief of ANSIA, which is a solutions-focused nonprofit magazine published out of Minnesota. The mission of our magazine is to share stories and to ignite conversations that motivate and empower people to help shape a more sustainable future. And we do this by publishing solutions-focused content covering a variety of challenges at the intersection of people and planet related to air, water, health, biodiversity, business interests, variety of topics in that regard. And the next thing I'd like to do before I answer the prompt question is to find out who you are, because I think that's an important part of being on this panel as well. If you are a staff reporter, staff reporters here? Okay. How about freelance journalists, editors, public information or public relations? Staff. Okay, we've got a really good mix here. The reason that I ask you that is ties into what is one of the challenges that I think journalism has and one of the things we can do better, and that is to not make assumptions about our audience. I think we tend to make assumptions about whether people are interested in the stories that we're writing. We're interested in environmental topics, so we think that the people we're communicating with are. We make assumptions about our audience's political affiliation. Far too often I run across environmental stories that essentially equate environmentalism with liberalism or liberal politics, thereby alienating at least half of the population right out of the gate. We make assumptions about race. We make assumptions about gender. We make assumptions about what our audience cares about. And every time we make an assumption, we're essentially cutting out part of our potential audience. Why does this matter? It matters because environmental issues are everyone's issues, whether they know it or not. And if we are going to help people understand topics and engage with topics that are important to their lives, we need to reach through, and we do that by not alienating and understanding the breadth of our audience.
Thank you. So I guess the first question that I have for the panel, and remember you guys can chime in at any time, it's sort of what are ways that you've attempted to broaden your message? What have you found works? What have you found doesn't work? And how do you know when your efforts have resonated? And that's for everyone.
Okay, I'll go first. it's very easy for a lot of people to write off what I have to say because I'm paid by an environmental nonprofit. So for us to broaden our message, it's very important to get actual people in the community, especially people that are respected. And medical professionals are quite important because when your doctor says something, you listen to. We have a collection of medical professionals that we're trying to get their files ready, have them ready to go for speaking engagements, for reporting inquiries. Doctors, especially general practitioners, when, you know, are you smoking? Do you have cancer in your history? Do they ever ask, do you live near a source of air pollution? Do you burn wood in your home? Almost never. We're trying to change those conversations. There's a lot of good work done being done here in the Pittsburgh region about asthma. We have quite above average national levels, specifically. So also athletes. People love athletes. When the star running back of the NFL, Jerome Bettis of the Steelers, talks about his asthma, his fans care. They don't care most of them don't care when I talk about it. We did not get Jerome Bettis to do any of our events, but we do have partnerships reaching out with other athletes. We have a campaign called Athletes United for Healthy Air, where we put on walks in the park. We look for lichens, which are bioindicators of air quality. We look at sources of pollution, and we get people out enjoying nature as well. We put monitors on the front of bicycles that measure particulate matter as we bike around. I do have the helmet here on purpose in case you take a picture, help normalize cycling. I put my Twitter here as well. Tweets would be great. Sometimes when you broaden your message as to the question, how do you know if it's resonating? Anytime you leave the house, there's a risk that something's going to happen. And when you broaden your message, the broader it gets, the more you can lose control of it. And this is dangerous, but also exciting. And one example is we hosted a community meeting about a certain steel foundry. And quite often these are very calm affairs. 20, 30 people come out to learn about a permit. In this one, 70 employees of the company showed up as well. And they were intimidating. And the message got out broadly, and that's how we knew it resonated because a lot of people showed up. So what ended up happening, though, is the community saw managers handing employees questions to ask. The community smelled the burning metal aroma that was soaked into the employees' clothes and was able to link that with the smell they smell in their neighborhood. The community saw workers interrupt us, yell at us. So while it was an uncomfortable evening, I think the message did go out quite broadly. And I think neutral people in that room were pushed more toward the message we had to share. So would I recreate that night again? No, but it might happen. And the broader the message gets out, the more exciting things can be.
So I teach environmental policy at Pittsburgh, and I think my student actually taught me something very important. She actually wrote, we need to figure out what people care about and don't assume that people care about what you care about, in terms of trying to get the environmental concerns to a greater number of people. I think we just need to go back to basics that, you know, environment is about clean water, clean air. There are bread and butter issues about trade-offs. There's public integrity issues, and there's also environmental justice issues. So I don't actually see a distinction between environmental issues and all these other issues that really, you know, get under our skin. So
just to add to that a little bit, one of the things that we do at ANSIA Magazine is when we assign a story, we ask ourselves two questions. And one of them is, what is this story about? And the other one is, who is this story for? And we're not allowed to use the word environment to answer either of those questions. So the story is about business. The story is about clean water. The story is about healthy children. But we're trying to get ourselves beyond just, you know, slapping the environment label on the story and saying that's what this is, and saying what is it about that will resonate for a wide variety of audiences.
And to add to that, another example of something that's worked well with GASP is we are part of a coalition called Pittsburgh United. And Pittsburgh United is made up of labor groups, faith groups, environmental groups, and community groups. And we all come together to work on goals we can agree to share. A few years ago, we worked together to get past a trilogy of bills here at Pittsburgh City Council related to clean air, clean water, and prevailing wage. And the mayor of Pittsburgh now, who was city councilman then, said in the council chambers, he looked around, he saw the union people with all their same colored shirts on, he saw clergy with collars, he saw the environmental people, and he said, this never would have happened without all of you being together on this. We're getting out of our normal communities, we're unifying on what does unify us. It's not just, oh, that's an environmental issue for the environmental section. Clean air is clean water is for everyone. So we've had quite a few successes working in that coalition.
That brings me to another question, sort of what do you think are some of the best practices in terms of connecting to people who aren't necessarily engaged with environmental issues?
Well, I'll go down the line, sure. I think the most important thing is listen to what their values are. An athlete, it's not normal. I think we're kind of weird because of what we do. We're so focused on environmental issues, air quality. I think it's normal that people understand ground-level ozone and care about benzene parts per million. And that's just not really everyone's normal day life. So what do they care about? Well, people riding bicycle suddenly realize the stuff coming out of that diesel truck in front of them is disgusting, and it smells disgusting, and why do they have to breathe that, and what's that doing to them? And that gets them involved in air quality issues. I have a great story about an endangered tree frog in California that an airport was expanding and encroaching upon its habitat, and a group was paid to survey the community. An environmental group wanted to stop this frog from going extinct, and the surveyors came back and said, oh, we have excellent news. Everyone's against this airport expansion, total victory. They hate the idea because they don't want traffic, anything that adds one more minute to their commute, they hate. And the group said, oh, no, they have to do it for the frog. They have to like the frog. And no, they actually don't. So I don't care why you come into this, but whether it's you want to save money by replacing the light bulbs in your building, or whether it's your child has asthma and suddenly you're looking for ways to protect this person you never thought of air quality before, just respect your audience's values, not because you're respecting them as people, and also because it's effective.
I think I'll just echo that. It all depends on your audience. What do they really care about? And what angle do they come to this issue?
That sounds good. And just to add to a couple of other ways to get outside of our bubbles or to connect with people who are not already engaged in environmental issues. For NCM Magazine, part of what we do is our content is all published Creative Commons, so that means it can be republished at no cost by other outlets. And part of what we do is try to connect it with outlets that would perhaps have different audiences than our own magazine would. In the same way, we also we share our stories extensively through social media. And there are a number of ways with social media that you can engage audiences that aren't your direct audiences. And then again, just I would reiterate to not make assumptions about our audiences, and with our with the people who are doing the reporting for us, to make sure that they access a wide range of sources and not just go to all the same sources all the time.
Before I ask another question, I just want to see if anyone has any questions.
Primarily, but I'm a freelancer based in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I hear what you all are saying for sure, but I also worry that from the top down, an environment has become increasingly partisan, and that a set of, even though I think everyone, yes, of course, no matter their political party, they care about clean air, clean water, but they're getting this message from their leaders, some of them, that, you know, climate change isn't real, and a set of these other issues are not, and that we're, small businesses are overregulated, or, you know, any number of some of these messages that are getting sent down. And so how do we, as journalists, in an objective way, reach out to the, you know, again, reach a broad audience, but also, I'm worried that, like, only the choir and only the bubble are reading my stories. And so I wonder, what can I do to broaden that audience?
So I'm just repeating it for the internet audience, but Elizabeth is worried that environmental issues have basically become partisan, and she wants to know, how do we objectively reach a broad audience? How do we, like, extend outside our bubble?
I'll just comment briefly on that. I understand that there is that very strong predisposition, especially in this country right now, that there is that divide. I think we may not be able to overcome it, but we can at the least not contribute to it by framing our own messages in those polarized ways. And the other thing, and I think this is echoing previous comments too, is find what that common ground is. Find something that is something about the issue that you're covering that is pertinent to people across the political spectrum, and use that as your frame rather than politics.
So I think a more coverage on issues and showing that how it actually has support from both red, blue, purple, green, white, whatever, right? So I'm just thinking about renewable energy, right? Renewable energy in Texas is growing tremendously, and it has tremendous support from all sorts of political persuasion. The same case in Iowa. So I think, you know, having more coverage and getting people to understand these are not partisan issues. There is support for renewable energy just based on, you know, nickel and dime money kind of ideas, right, that brings in a lot of people under the umbrella. Renewable energy also attracts people who are green and, like, liberals. But it's not really a partisan issue. So I'd love to see more coverage by journalists on these kind of issues.
Yeah, I agree. I believe there's a small group of people high above us that profit off of lying to us. And most of us can unify on a lot more issues than we think. You do have to respond with the facts. If someone says this new regulation will kill jobs and cost billions of dollars, et cetera, I would love to see the next two sentences say, the previous 30 regulations of this scope actually saved X billion. I mean, because they have. So that's the kind of context I would love. As far as getting outside of the normal bubble of people that read, perhaps combining renewable energy combined with the business reporting beat to talk about that sector, for talk to the health reporters and talk about blood levels of lead in the school districts. Talk to the education people. What are there any schools with green practices with the chemicals they use and renovations and remediations and just trying to tie it into the other beats that are already out there. Is that jarnt? Is that how you? I don't know how you talk. You talk about beats. Is that a thing? Okay. All right.
Any other questions? Okay. So, what do you find, or what do you think is most polarizing about the way in which journalists tend to report about environmental issues? Like, what are, like, red flags or trigger words that you think tend to kick people out of the club, so to speak?
That's not the question she prompted us with before.
It is. It's just more words. It is.
Well, I'm going to answer the question I think I wanted you to ask, which is similar, which was It was about polarization, though. And is there a fear that you're turning people off by certain words or terms? I'm actually worried that the opposite would happen. Because I believe when you're given new information, you're going to move in a certain direction. And that might be toward a sharper end of the scale. And what I don't like is when I mentioned it earlier, and I reviewed, we keep track of the hits, you know, when we get in the media, and I reviewed some of the articles and the ones I liked and the ones that made me mad. And the ones that make my job harder are ones that add context that take away from the thrust of the message. So there's so many Pittsburgh stories that start with, everyone knows we used to have to change our shirts at lunch, and the streetlights were on all day, and now that's no longer the case. However, there's still work to be done. And the rest of the article is great. It's all about the work to be done and the current challenges. But I fear that that opening paragraph is an inoculation against everything else that's coming. Okay, it's getting better, little by little each year, next. And that might make perfect sense in a big overview piece, especially if you're not from here. But when I see it every other day, I feel that it can blunt the message we're, you know, trying to put out. So, sure.
So you work for a nonprofit, and so it seems like there's a message you're sending, and there's a message that we as reporters need to report, and that is not. And sometimes what we're reporting is in lock with your message, but we're not like your mouthpiece. And right. So I guess the question is, how do you balance that awareness of the fact that we do have to? We're not, you know, your your PR people. Is that the word? Yes, we are not your PR people.
I'm going to leave that to you guys to figure. Yeah.
But anyone else with like the polarizing question?
I actually have a question for the audience. I'm going to break a little bit from the pattern. So one thing that really, you know, reading news articles, I sometimes get this sense that there's an attempt to give balanced coverage, which means you give same amount of coverage to position A and same amount of coverage to position B, and that's considered balance, right? So I'm wondering whether journalists have a responsibility to also evaluate position A and position B and come at least put it in a way that when it's so clear that position A is not factually based and position B is factually based, how do journalists approach this? You know, you need to be fair and balanced, but at the same time, being fair and balanced means also distinguishing between fact and fiction, right? So I want to get your response on your thoughts on this issue.
Entertaining, and in an effort to eliminate false balance that I may have just created right here, I will point out that John Oliver, by his own admission, is not a journalist, but he is very entertaining. I think most of us actually would prefer to be able to cover these things like that, but you're of course dealing with limited space, deadlines, and things like that, where often you can't really parse bad science from good science as much as you might like. Certainly you should be putting up with 97% of working climatologists believe climate change and 3% don't. That perhaps we should be including the people that don't, but also noting that they are an extreme minority. In other cases, we may not have the space or the time to get into the details of scientific arguments and show the nuance. If the problems with the balance are more nuanced, then really
can that is that you would you owe them the chance to respond, but it's about an opinion. That's one thing. But if someone says something that then I can't, a factual thing that then I can't go in and verify it, I'm not gonna.
I guess, I mean, that's part of the challenge what SEJ has always been about. I think that probably most of the people in this room and at this conference don't practice the kind of journalism you're talking about. Most of the people that do aren't here. And that we somehow have an organization and its colleagues to reach them and somehow try to have a conversation about that. I think, you know, it stems from the old sort of, you know, journalism 101 political. Everything's a political story, and one person says this, one person says that, and you figure it out. That doesn't work, and it's actually malpractice in what we do most of the time. But I think we all have to try to bridge that gap beyond this room and beyond this organization.
You have to say, as somebody who's in reporting in D.C. for a long time, where your story actually is a political story, you're sort of hamstrung, right? If you're writing about the debate in Congress and, you know, one party doesn't believe in the science and the other party does, well, you know, you can't write a story that's, you know, represents the debate without also representing that side. So, you know, it's about inserting the, you know, that sort of stock line that, you know, this mission does not represent the views of 97% of scientists, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, sometimes you are stuck where you do have to put in a quote from somebody who is denying the science because that's how you write a balanced political story.
And just to follow up on that, I actually think that when we look at the traction that a lot of, to be kind, misinformative media on both sides of the political spectrum, but particularly on one side of the political spectrum, they got a lot of traction when we refused to include statements that they had made that, you know, were not supported by science, to just say, oh, well, you know, the liberal media is just snuffing opinions that they don't agree with. So, you know, very often we know something isn't accurate or isn't supported by the science, but, you know, if it's a congressman that said this publicly or, you know, in some other way, it's come out in a very dramatic or well-distributed way, we're kind of forced to include that. You know, if we have time, we can, you know, put in information to refute that claim, but to not cover that side altogether is to give the other side the great advantage of saying that we are, you know, only including information that we agree with.
I think one really important piece of that is not just to say what the science says, what we need to know, but how do we know it? Here at the world where I work, until last November, we had pretty much said we don't need to go into all the background on climate science anymore. Like, you know, there's an accepted, you know, it certainly from story to story it varies, but that there's, you know, basically sort of accepted consensus. Our audience understands that, and we can get on to talking about detail. We kind of threw that out the window because we realized that we were reminded that there is a huge percentage of the country that just doesn't think that way, and that we can't just sort of assert things, even if, you know, even if we don't talk about the 3%, if we don't give them credence, 3% of the climate scientists who don't think it's real, as an example. But how do the 97% know what they know? Why do we believe this? Why do we accept that as fact? And to drill into that as often as possible, and to try to get out of that bubble with people are already convinced that this is real, because that's not getting through to huge swath of our country.
So I have a question piggybacking on Shanti's and stealing a little bit from Mary. So I have a, like, by a show of hands, how many people would say 50% of Americans believe in climate change? 60%? Like, so I'm starting at 50 as a middle, but I'm going to keep going up. So 70% of Americans? 80? 90? 100? I'm going for gold. So based on 2016 data, it's over 70% of Americans believe climate change is real. It gets a little fuzzier with whether or not they believe it's human caused. But even human caused is more than 50%. And it's gone up since 2016 because of hurricane season. So I also worry a little that we worry too much about the percentage of people who don't believe in climate change. And I bring this up because I wrote a story about this sort of, and I use an example about a guy who rubbed a lemon on his face because he thought it would make him invisible to the camera, and he robbed a bank and it didn't make him invisible. It's a very weird story. Anyway, I got this weird email, but the article was essentially like how we have our biases, and because of our biases, we tend to do things like this guy who rubbed lemon juice on his face and robbed a bank, only not that severe. And it was like, we have these biases, and because of these biases, some of us are predisposed not to believe in climate change because our community says we shouldn't and all of these things. And I got this very weird email from this gentleman who is like, I am a climate scientist. And I Googled him. He was not. He's clearly lying. And he was like, but you compared me to a man who puts lemon juice on his face. And so what he was really telling me was like shame, because I'd done it in a framework that sort of said we all exist within this framework. I hadn't said these weirdos exist within this framework. I said we all are this man who puts lemon juice on his face, which we are to different degrees. And so I just wonder if we worry too much about who these people, like we treat these people like they are these people and not enough like they are us with the same biases, and it just manifests in a way that we don't maybe necessarily agree with.
Just to reiterate and build on that, I think any we versus them framing is counterproductive.
I'll go to you. So I'm Nathan. I'm a freelance journalist. And one of the challenges I have, I do a lot of global reporting, and I have a really hard time like getting people in the U.S. to care about global stories that are really distant to them. So I think like talking about clean air and clean water in Pittsburgh, a factory here is easy, but trying to get them to care about haze in Indonesia or sea level rise in the Philippines is really, really hard. So I was wondering if you had any ideas on how to make something that seems very distant relevant to local audiences, and maybe a way to build awareness about the fact that climate and environmental issues are not just like local, they're also global, and they're all interconnected.
I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of science that connects.
I just need to repeat the question. So Nathan wants to know how we can better make global environmental issues resonate sort of in the United States.
I was just going to say, there's a lot of science now showing that, you know, haze in New Delhi affects droughts in the U.S., affects particulates in California. You know, when there's overfishing goes on in the coast of Africa because of developed nations going in and doing overfishing in the coast of Africa, what happens there? People switch to bushmeat, which means they get exposed to viruses in the wildlife, and that has an effect on AIDS. So it's extremely interconnected. So maybe these kind of, you know, science has not gotten out to the general public.
We have that same challenge at ANSIA magazine because we do tell stories from around the world, and it's difficult even when we provide them to engage people outside of their own communities and their own sphere of sort of caring and understanding. And the one, we haven't cracked that nut yet, but the one piece of advice I would suggest is the more you can bring human interest, bring real people and their families and their illnesses or their well-being, whatever it is, into the story and make it a story about people that resonates with everyone.
I would agree. I would think in the globalized world we have, just one example comes to mind. Flooding in Australia years ago affected coal mines of a certain kind of coal that's called metallurgical coal that's used to make coke, which is then used to make steel, which affects all the prices of all these things. So in this region, we have the nation's largest coke-making facility a few miles south of here. We have steel mills. We have coal mines everywhere. So perhaps tying it back in a market way, how did that commodity affect what's going on here? And then how does that affect communities and individual stories? Might work.
Someone who wrote on a scientific findings on climate change that say human activity is partially responsible. And the other thing from that workshop that is very, very true, certainly in my experience, is that facts do not change people's minds.
Thank you. I think there's another question. She said to that we, instead of saying do you believe in climate change, we should say do you accept the scientific consensus around climate change, and a reminder that there's actually a lot of data that suggests that facts don't change minds. The woman behind you, and then
I'm Patricia DiMarco. I'm the host of a radio program on the Union Edge Labor Talk Radio. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to speak to your issue about 70% of Americans thinking climate change is real, but yet we do not hold people who are running for office accountable for a position on this. And how can the press take a more active role in seeing to it that people who are running for office actually express an opinion and respond to this concern, which is generalized in the public, but we don't hear about it, we don't talk about it. You know.
Anyone?
Did you want to restate it?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm a terrible moderator. and, of course, I did that on the mic. she wanted to know sort of how we can better, I guess, hold political candidates or elected officials sort of accountable to their opinions on climate change, given that so many Americans actually believe in climate change or accept the science.
Could I ask a question in response? If any of you have taken a class on, what would you call it, on pretending you're me and pretend like, what are some ways to handle the media? Yeah, role playing. Have you been on like that side of it? Yes. For example, I've gone through trainings how to speak to the media on your topic, and I think it'd be great if the media heard what was going on those trainings too. So, holding people accountable. People with a message are trained, and they practice, and they role play, and they pivot, and they want to get back to what they want to say. And I love when reporters, you know, say, "Well, what do you think about nuclear disarmament?" And they say, "Well, that's a great question. We need women and children to," and that's when the pivot's done poorly. But they're trying to get off of your question, so recognize what's happening and spin them back.
I think you had a question?
Yeah. So everybody, going back to, journalism 101, conflict is one of the most basic of news values. That is something that people report in stories. On one hand, it may alienate folks, but on the other hand, it actually does draw a lot of audience. How can we better use that news value of conflict without having it be as polarized as you all described?
How can we report on conflict with it being less polarizing? Without making it so polarizing, I guess it's a better way of restating it.
Conflict is obviously one of the major components of good story, but so are the other two C's, which are character and change. And I think if we continue on past, the conflict can't be the entire story, I guess is what I'm trying to say. We can carry that through to who is involved, kind of bring in the people angle of it, and then go all through to the change. So what are we going to do about that? And then move the conversation forward and not just let the conflict be the story.
Peter Kelly, American Wind Energy Association. So actually, I had a comment on both of the recent comments. On the matter of not just letting the conflict be the story, in my 13 years in journalism, I was given the maxim that you go beyond the who, what, why, when, and where with Has it happened before? Is it likely to happen again? Who's responsible? And is there a remedy? And so that became part of the mantra that I was trained in through a University of Michigan professor. And I think it's important to get to those other questions and not just get stuck in the conflict. And that can reveal some universal values. But on the matter of being trained to pivot, I mean, I'm one of the guys who does that media training, and I have for a number of years now. And I would say that there's an insight that I got from somebody named Gregory Bateson, a sociologist, that every conversation at some level is a battle of framing and reframing, that we're always trying to frame things the way we see them, and then the other person tries to frame them the way they see them. And that's not unique to a journalist questioning a source. It's really every conversation between two human beings. And I would say it's in the interest of the journalist that the source not adopt their frame. Because it's their frame, it's a journalist's frame. And you actually want to know what the source's frame is. Because otherwise, you're not actually learning what that frame looks like and why they think that way. And that is your job as a journalist, to get them to stay their frame, not necessarily yours. And especially on technical matters, who knows more about the technical matter? It hopefully, let's just say, it's a source, because otherwise, why are you talking to them in the first place? So let's grant, for the sake of your argument, they actually do know more. Then you need to find out what their frame is, and they should pivot back to their expertise and back to what they feel strongly about and how they see the world. And so I think it's maybe, I would hate for journalists to emerge kind of aroused by, oh my God, they're trying to pivot back to their message. Well, maybe they're just trying to actually get to where their expertise is.
In the back.
Mark Morgenstein, Public Interest Network. I've been doing media relations for about 3 months after 23 years as a journalist. Mm-hmm. And I think Mary has it mostly right. I think there's a close cousin to conflict, which is adversity. And the key to this is having character-driven stories about people overcoming adversity. So it doesn't need to be a conflict. It's this transpartisan adversity. It's someone who's responding to a hurricane flood in their home. It doesn't matter if they're a Republican or Democrat. It doesn't matter if they accept climate change or not. You find that character who you can follow, who becomes the embodiment of the story, who it doesn't matter what your political situation is, what beliefs are. It's the old edict of show me, don't tell me. And by having that person, showing what's happened to that person, you don't need to tell. People can see, and even if they are predisposed to one side of the argument, that actual thing, that could be their grandmother, that could be their nephew, that could be their dog, that's how I think you're able to kind of transcend the partisanship.
So another question. One thing that we've learned from vaccine reporting is that if you tell people sort of, if you write a story that's sort of like, vaccines don't cause cancer, people emerge believing that vaccines cause cancer. we have very weird lizard brains. Partly because the person probably never thought vaccines cause cancer, but now you've entered that doubt in their mind. And so I guess the question I have for the panel, if I can get my phone to unlock, is how do you present facts and data in a way that actually supports the message you're trying to tell and doesn't accidentally give readers the opposite message, sort of? Or like, how do you give facts and data in a way of that supports your story?
So this is, I think you'll know what I'm talking about too. If someone says, my opponent is an arsonist and he goes out every Friday night and burns down homes, ridiculous. The response should not be, I do not go out and burn down homes. I am not an arsonist, because that brain hears, I am arsonist. And the not and the but and the and, it doesn't process very well. And it is the framing of it. And what I do is I respond with, of course, I would leave the room if that were the question, but I don't repeat the opposite framing, and I repeat my positive vision. And yes, it will be up to all of you to, that is my area of expertise, and that those are the facts that I believe, and then it'll be up to you to categorize and sift through all that, but...
Actually, I think my task is a little bit more difficult because I tend to do peer-reviewed articles, which means that you report what you find and then you report all the caveats. And I'm often forced to, like, provide a shorter version of it without all the caveats. So I think my question would be, how do you speak, how do you, you know, drill down to this very short... sentence you're supposed to give to a reporter when whatever research you do has a lot of caveats, and it's important to have the caveats, right? So when I write this book on shale and it's a dilemma, it's not taking one position versus the other. I'm trying to explain to you why it's a dilemma, right? And I'm often forced to like give you a much shorter version that doesn't capture the richness of the story. So I'm on the other side of the dilemma. Right.
Facts and data are always a challenge to try to convey in an appropriate way. The two things that we try to do is, first of all, to, however we can, personify them. So to put real people, connect real people to the numbers so that they're not abstract. And then, of course, any kind of visual resource that we can provide, whether it's an infographic or a you know, some kind of an interactive chart or something like that that tells the story in more of a dynamic way, I think is helpful.
And then this is a question, I guess, both for the panel but also for the audience, is do you have experiences where you feel that you've really done that, where you've broken through the bubble that you'd want to relate, you know, tell us about? That's disheartening.
It's hard to know because, well, like, we anyway get so little feedback from our audience.
Sorry?
We give so little feedback from our audience. You know, we get stuff from Facebook and Twitter and all that, but we just don't get a lot of direct feedback from audience. And no matter how hard we try to do that, we don't really know whether we've succeeded. But I think, you know, what we're trying to do is sort of go beyond feedback to our usual output, which is a radio program and then a very bad website. It is to find other ways to reach audiences and broaden our conversation. And at the very least, you know, we may not know how we're doing, but we will be engaging with people who are outside of the usual public radio demographic. We haven't succeeded in doing that yet, but we're trying.
So,
I don't know if that will give us any answers, but at least it will hopefully sort of push the conversation forward.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jessica. I'm the environment editor at CityLab in the Atlantic, and we're a very new channel. And one of the struggles that we are facing in trying to gauge the reach of our stories and our success in getting to new audiences is that, you know, there are a lot of different ways of evaluating success of the story. Like, metrics are one kind of raw way of thinking about that. But, you know, we often find that the stories that have the biggest reach are not necessarily the ones that we think are most important for our readers to engage with. And so that's something that I would definitely welcome a lot more thought and discussion around. You know, we think about it in terms of the vegetables and dessert model. Like, we're always happy, you know, about the possibility of recirculation in stories. Like, if we get somebody with a really but that's not necessarily one that they're marinating over for a long time and are writing us emails about or leaving comments on the site about or writing Facebook messages to us. You know, how do we then get those people to become regular readers and get a sense of what is important to them and what their values actually are, you know, beyond just clicking like on a story?
I'm Kira Sianza. I'm a producer for you, Sustainability Pioneer Short Documentaries. And from the this morning's session, I went to the Doomsday workshop. One of the things that was my takeaway there was that how when we report about climate change, it leads people feeling hopeless. And quite often, the way we report is kind of like pushes people being stuck. spectators. And once you have the feeling that this awful thing is happening and I'm a spectator, I feel hopeless. I just want to disengage. So what can we do as media organization representatives to go out there where the people are, out of our bubbles, and listen more and kind of like engage them, and instead of change the structures, like we report to you how things are, instead of like hear what people think and make you more interactive. This is a question to everybody.
If I can just respond to, was it Jessica?
Oh, I should.
Kirsten.
I should repeat our question. Sure. Basically, if you can tell me if I'm butchering your question, but how can we get people to be feeling less hopeless when reading climate change stories and feeling more engaged? So I guess what you're sort of saying is, like, how do we get people to be more engaged, but also turn it into more of a climate change conversation as opposed to a discrete story, like a beginning, middle, and end?
If I can just respond to that, one word that you said I pulled out from all the rest, and that is the word listen. I think that is absolutely the key to this. I just last week heard a talk by I'm from the Twin Cities, from Minnesota, and our local public radio environment reporter essentially has taken a sabbatical for a couple of months. She has put together a Facebook group around food and agriculture issues that engage farmers, urban foodies, the whole spectrum, and she has created a conversation on Facebook among people who never would have talked to each other otherwise, and it's been remarkably civil and remarkably insightful. And as a reporter, she is listening. And I can only imagine how much more depth and value there will be to her reporting because of that.
I won't ask you, but I have a question. For those of you who are on like staff publications, how many of you, or like on publications, how many of you get like emails from your readers? How many of you, if you have comments on your website, or you actually go to Facebook and torture yourself and read the comments? One. Okay, a few. Do you have a sense of who your audience is beyond like, you know, metric, you know, beyond like sort of whatever Parsley or Chartbeat or whatever I'm getting? Raise your hand if you do have a sense, and raise your hand if you don't have a sense. You're writing in the void. Okay, that's helpful. Fair. So I write for PopSci. The thing is wrong. And one of the things we noticed, I think that's more helpful than the individual comments, was we have a lot of anti-climate change commenters. But after Harvey, the tenor of the conversation changed. A lot more of the commenters were basically telling the deniers to be quiet in less pleasant words. And so there was a beautiful 3-week window where where that was tamped down, because I guess it was so terrible that it felt like people felt like this is not a message that we could tolerate at that time. And it's since kind of gone back to normal. But I think, yes, you're right that like it isn't necessarily an accurate viewpoint of who all of your readers are, but it is, I think, changes in how in tone can in the commenting can tell you a lot about your readers.
this might be the opposite of what you wanted to hear, but it might be helpful to think that you don't have a general audience. That's not a real thing. Everyone's an individual. You have a mother with two children that play soccer, and her father's in the hospital. And she will resonate, a different piece you wrote will resonate with that person than someone else. Never read the comments. There were a few questions about positivity and engagement, and I just had a brief story about a group here called ACAN, Allegheny County Clean Air Now. There was a Coke Works that's now closed, and as a result of some legal settlement, they had to meet regularly with citizens. So my group was attended these meetings, and they were local interested people downwind of the facility. And this went on for years, lots of stories. You know, they cooked us stinky food to hide the smell of the facility when we were there. Eventually, our people left. The citizens left because they felt they were being used to greenwash the facility. The place closed. This group of citizens is now on their own. They're independent. They formed their own Facebook, their own Twitter. They're going after C3. They don't need me or anyone else anymore, and that's amazing. And I would have loved an embedded journalist, you know, there checking in once every few months or filming, because they would do observations from a cliff of plumes of fire. There was Carnegie Mellon University involved. And it's a positive story, and they're going strong now. They're maybe getting solar panels, a solar farm where there used to be a Coke Works facility, maybe. But.
So my name is Renee Lurksman. I work as a consultant. I do transfer more than communication consulting. So I'm following on what Kirstie just raised around what I'm hearing around the kind of relationship that we have with our readers and our audience and so forth. And I'm just, it's making me think about a project I did years ago in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I'm just going to share it in like two, like 1 minute. See how it lands and what it does for how we're thinking about this. So I spent time living in Green Bay interviewing people about the Great Lakes, about the Fox River, and about the water, basically. And what I was hearing from people, mainly working class, not engaged with the environment at all, what I was hearing from people throughout the conversations was that they felt an incredible grief and loss over what was happening with the water, but at the same time, there was a lot of conflict around their own relationship with industry in the area. The industry had also kind of made the area what it was, and some had family working in the mill, and what does it mean to want the water to be cleaned up? What does that mean to allegiance and loyalty to the history and the region? And there's a lot of conflict. And so I ended up writing this up, and my book is here. It's called Environmental Melancholia. But the point is that we're talking about kind of what angles to be looking at. And when we think about environmental degradation and climate change, there's a lot of dilemmas and cognitive dissonance and conflicts that come up for all kinds of people for all kinds of reasons. And that's the story that's not really being told. We tend to focus on this is what's happening and here's what we can do about it. There's kind of subtext going on of like, here's the problem, we need to deal with it. What about, you know, covering the real lived experience of people wrestling with these issues who care deeply but feel really stuck and they don't know what to do and so they don't do anything. It doesn't mean they don't care. To me, there's like a vast treasure trove of stories to be told from the human angle around what climate change means, what does it bring up, what is it forcing us to have to contend with, and how as a community or communities can we work through that? And one of the ways is by acknowledging those conflicts and those dilemmas. I think that's like kind of the big story that I don't hear a whole lot of.
Just to paraphrase, you're basically saying that like one of the untold stories or unheard stories of climate change is sort of what does climate change mean and how can we... What does climate change mean sort of as a society or as a community? And what are the dilemmas that it brings up and how can we sort of address them? And not just sort of the practical dilemmas, but sort of the emotional or the, like, what does it mean to lose coal in coal country? Because it's not just about coal, it's also about your identity as a coal miner or whatever. Yeah.
Or it could relate to food, it could relate to fishing, it could relate to
I think you had a question.
Maybe a third of the story with here are some even small steps that people have done to deal with this, and I guess following up on you know, somebody else with a book out and having done a ton of work on the wildfire crisis over probably you know, really over 25 years, but particularly on this book for the last 7 or 8 years, the comments that I got on stories that I've done throughout the process of working on that book were often very hostile, insulting, disagreeing with terms and things that I was presenting in the book. But it's been pretty interesting to go particularly to stakeholders for book events that I'm invited to do, to firehouses, community organizations, who ostensibly would be communities that would have the same people that are writing these comments, and actually see an entirely different response when you're talking to people in person or when you're dealing with things in person. And the one thing that I found really helpful and really successful, getting back to Kirsty's comment, was to introduce myself and do my little multimedia talk, but to point out that these are people that live in the mountains, and many of them probably know more about this subject, or at least aspects of it, than I do. And I'd really appreciate it if you guys would talk to me or correct me or you know, raise your hand as we're going through this, and you know, let's have this be a conversation rather than me talking about this issue or you know, working on a story about this issue.
I think we're kind of hitting the end of our time, so I guess this is sort of like last questions, last comments, sort of last licks. Starting with you, and then you. Yeah. So a plug for print media, ideally affordable print media, especially that goes out to rural areas without broadband access, and basically inserting environmental stories into those publications where people aren't necessarily looking for environmental messaging, but they might actually read them. And then
I want to just give one word about concern for how you broaden the whole message of the environmental importance, the existential challenges of climate change and global pollution, is to raise the impact on those who are not yet born, who have no voice. And, you know, people care about the future if they care about their children. And making that connection that the decisions we're making today are going to affect people who have no voice at the table. And infusing a responsibility to think ahead for the consequences of our actions. I think that is a really critical part of the change agent that we just don't talk enough about.
So she said that we should think about framing it in terms of like future generations, future children, those who aren't yet at the table but will be significantly affected. So I'm just going to turn it to the panel and see if anyone else has any more comments that they want to make before we head out.
I would just like to add to Michael's plug for the Solutions Journalism Network. If you're not familiar with it, look it up online. It's not about Pollyanna reporting. It is about telling the entire story.
NCIA is a member of that. The network offers workshops around the country at request. So if your outlet has any interest in that, connect with the network and see what they can do for you.
I just want to thank all the journalists for doing fabulous work, because I really rely on your work quite a bit when I teach, especially some of the new current stuff that's not in peer-reviewed journals. So I really rely on your stuff. And it's especially helpful when you guys find this trove of documents and you post it online, because then I can get my students to actually read the original rather than, you know, the journalist's take on it. And it's actually extremely helpful. So thank you very much.
Thanks for letting me bumble around the room, break some things. Hope it was entertaining. If you're looking for a little red meat conflict, while I was sitting here, I've been getting attacked on Twitter by the director of communications for CONSOL Energy. So check us out on Twitter. And
I think I'm supposed to tell you guys to go to the ballroom or whatever that room is for like the SEJ member meeting, which I think starts at 3:30. I'm very bad with schedules. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.